Another South Florida county bans gay conversion therapy for minors. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Broward County Commissioners voted unanimously this week to ban the controversial therapy. Palm Beach County did it last month. Miami-Dade? Not yet. We'll talk with the head of an advocacy group in South Florida about what the therapy entails and efforts to ban it statewide. There's a thing called reference pricing. It could become a disruptor in the healthcare marketplace. We'll explain. And we'll also discuss an effort to make needle exchanges legal statewide. And finally, a conversation with author Min Jin Lee. She wrote the National Book Award finalist Pachinko, a fictional tale of a Korean family trying to find a better future in pre- and post-war Japan. Lee will be at the Murakami Museum and Japanese Garden this week to discuss the book. All of that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Conversion therapy for minors is now illegal in Broward County. It means trying to psychologically change a person's gender identity or sexual orientation. Palm Beach County banned it last month. Other bans exist in Boca Raton, Miami, Miami Beach, West Palm Beach, Lake Worth, Boynton Beach, Delray Beach, Wellington, and Key West. Tony Lima is head of SAVE, an advocacy group for LGBTQ people here in South Florida, supporter of the bans. Tony, a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today. It's my pleasure.
Real briefly, just remind people, what is this gay conversion therapy? What is it supposed to do? How does it work?
So-called conversion therapy is a sham treatment which aims to cure people of their innate sexual orientation or gender identity. It's actually not a clinically tested medical therapy at all, and it's been tragically shown to lead to depression, anxiety, drug use, homelessness, self-harm, and even suicide, especially when practiced on young people. So it's something that's very harmful to our teens, mostly. And I think that it's important that as a state that we ban this terrible practice from continuing to happen.
And shown by who, by the way? Because you said that you called it a sham at the beginning, but shown by who that it doesn't
Absolutely.
Work.
So the medical opposition includes the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the World Health Organization. They've all come out against conversion therapy.
Now, the Broward...
Because in essence, there isn't a true and tried way, a scientific way, to be able to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity.
The Broward County Commission voted on this yesterday. What happened at the commission meeting?
I have to say I'm still living the joy of it all, because at SAVE, we are the longest serving LGBT rights organization in the state of Florida. And we've been at the helm of passing 8 of the conversion therapy bans that exist in municipalities across South Florida. And yesterday was unlike any other hearing that I've personally been at. The Broward Commission showed true leadership. They were unanimous in their vote. They heard over 30 testimonies. A good fourth of them were negative, from people that are actually supportive of conversion therapy. And several of the elected leaders voiced their opinions on how terrible they think this practice is. I think it's a wonderful message from Broward County to have voted unanimously. It's a great example for counties like Miami-Dade, where we still haven't been able to ban the practice of conversion therapy. It's something that SAVE is currently working on. But I love the fact that they were able to send a strong message to the young people in Broward County that they are accepted, that they can be their authentic selves, and that as adults, we're all supportive of them living safe, happy, and productive lives.
Now, supporters of, not the ban, but supporters of the therapy have challenged similar bans in court. Do you expect that to happen for Broward and Palm Beach counties?
You know, so far in the municipalities, I mean, Miami Beach and Miami date back over a year now. We haven't seen any kind of legal opposition. There have been threats at the state level several times, but none of them have prevailed. You know, the courts have consistently supported the fact that conversion therapy is a terrible thing for our young people.
And there's also a lawsuit in Tampa, right?
There's a lawsuit in Tampa that doesn't seem to be getting much traction at all. You know, it's become a messaging point for conservatives across the country. It's become a political issue. It's become an issue that people are citing, you know, the reason to be religious freedom or parental rights. But I think we have, you know, truth on our side. We have the interests of our young people on our side. And I expect that any of these lawsuits will be defeated as they have been in the past.
All right. Real quickly, if you could, I mean, supporters of this therapy say that this is basically a free speech issue and parental rights. You've heard the argument. What do you say to that?
I say that it's much more important to be protecting our young people from doing harm to themselves, from being victims of suicide in the end, because it's what ends up happening. The people that end up going through conversion therapy, a lot of the survivors, those that survive, including elected officials like Vice Mayor of Olton Manors, Dustin Flippin, can tell you the horrors that they went through. So I think of utmost importance, we have to protect our young people. We have to give them the tools, the freedom, and the possibility of living their authentic lives, living their as their authentic selves in a safe and productive and fruitful way.
In just a few
seconds. The only way that we can do this is to continue to ban conversion therapy.
In just a few seconds, can tell us what's next.
What's next? Well, hopefully we are able to challenge this at the state level. State Representative David Richardson, back in 2015, wrote a bill, basically, to propose banning conversion therapy statewide that got no traction whatsoever. At that point, he came to us, and we started working together on banning conversion therapy at the municipal level to also send a strong message to the state that this is something that needs to be addressed because it is focused on our future, our children, our teens. So I think once we continue to ban, you know, conversion therapy at the municipal level, at the county level, we will set our sights on the state.
Tony Lima is head of SAVE, an advocacy group for LGBTQ people here in South Florida. Again, yesterday, Broward County commissioners voted unanimously to ban gay conversion therapy, very controversial sort of therapy, to try to change a person's gender identity or sexual orientation. Tony, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still ahead, a new look at healthcare in the workplace. That's coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Insurance is getting more expensive for some companies and individuals. While some complain, others look for alternatives. In comes reference pricing. It's not that well known, but might become a true disruptor in the current healthcare market. WLRN's Sammy Mack reported on this recently, and she joins us now in studio to elaborate. Sammy, a pleasure.
Hey, Lewis.
Thank you so much for joining us. I never heard of this. Reference pricing.
Yeah, I'd never heard of this either.
How different is this from normal insurance?
Totally upside down different. So with normal insurance, you pay your monthly premium, your company, if you get insurance through work, which more Floridians get their insurance through work than from any other source, pays part of it, you pay part of it, and then, you know, you go into the doctor's office and you pay what you pay there. It might be coinsurance, it might be your, you know, whatever the set rate is for that kind of service or procedure. And you, as the consumer, sort of feel the pinch of the payment at the doctor's office or in your, you know, in your paycheck. But there's also this other layer of how you are paying for things that happens way before you ever get to the doctor's office. And that's because insurance companies, big insurance companies, and hospital systems, clinic systems, doctor's offices, they all get together and negotiate the rates for procedures and all that stuff well ahead of when you get into that space. And they negotiate these things in secret. There are non-disclosure agreements all around these things. So you don't actually know, as a consumer, what things are going to cost before they happen for the most part. There are not a lot of ways to get at that information. But let's say you're an employer and you're covering a ton of people and you're paying for this stuff. You, as the employer, are not allowed to know what those negotiated rates are between the insurance company you're about to hire and the networks in your area, the big hospital systems and stuff like that. And that makes a big difference because if they have, you know, really inexpensive, comparatively negotiated rates, you're going to pay less for your people. But if, you know, if the hospital system or the doctors are making more than average in that market, you're going to end up spending more over the course of a year. But you can't know ahead of time going into that what those negotiated rates are. So enter reference pricing, right? This is a form of paying for healthcare where instead of having all of those negotiated networks and all that stuff, the company just comes in and says, we will pay what Medicare pays plus a certain percentage. In the case of the business that I talked to, it's Medicare rates plus 30%. And Medicare rates are important because Medicare is a federal program. So the what Medicare pays is both completely public. So it's one of the few ways that cost is transparent. It's a little complicated to untangle when you start looking at it, but it's public. It's public information. And it is stable within a market. So what you end up having is a structure where you say, okay, I'm going to pay you what Medicare pays plus, in this case, 30%, take it or leave it. And that is kind of the idea behind reference pricing. It uses Medicare as a benchmark.
Take it or leave it. So that means they could leave it.
Yeah. Yeah, they can. So this is a really unusual way of doing things. And just for some idea of how unusual this is, I had never heard of this before, and I cover healthcare and healthcare pricing. And the insurance broker who I first spoke to about this, he had never heard of this before, but he was approached by a guy named Yos Sayet, who runs Chemo International, which is this company in Miami that sells chemicals and stuff for paints and coatings. They do a lot of business in the Caribbean and Latin America. And Sayed had come to this guy, Grand LeCompte, at Sable Benefits in Fort Lauderdale, and said, I'm tired of insurance. I don't like the way it works. It's not working for my people. It drives me crazy. This is a really messed up system, which are things he later said to me. And he had read a line in a story about this form of payment and asked Grant if there was a way to do it in South Florida. And it took him 2 years to find a company that would cover a reference pricing company that would cover Yos' company here.
What's the price risk?
Well, that is one of the big criticisms of the way this works. Because there is no contract between the insurer and the provider, the doctor or hospital, there is nothing on paper stopping a hospital from charging you the full rate, whatever that is. And it's a lot more than what it would be if you had a negotiated contract. And in an emergency, it's hard to know what you're going to, it's hard to know what you're going to need ahead of time, even if it's not an emergency when you're sick. But in an emergency, there's really not time to stop and negotiate these things. And so one of the criticisms of this form is that it puts the consumer at much more financial risk, that they will be billed obscene amounts of money. What's interesting about the case that I looked at here in South Florida is that baked into this package, when they switched over to this form and used this other, they call them third-party administrators, but this other company that runs the reference pricing, baked into the services is negotiating support. So they have people who will negotiate the bills after the fact. And then if that fails, there is legal support. So they will have their legal departments, if worst case scenario, the nuclear option is to sue these guys. And then all of their prices would be revealed in court as a matter of public record. And so far, nobody's wanted to do that.
That kind of leads into what I was going to say. It's like, how is this going to be a disruptor?
Well,
so that's kind of, in a way, could be that right
yeah,
there you just said.
Yeah. And the way that this works in practice, it is a lot more work for the employee. It's also way less expensive to begin with. So those are kind of the two very obvious pros and cons. What you're more likely to see in terms of disruption is using reference pricing for common procedures. Maybe not for your entire healthcare plan, but we've seen in California the retirement system there, CalPERS, that insures retirees from public jobs in California. CalPERS went to this reference pricing method for really common procedures like joint replacements and colonoscopies, the sorts of procedures where what goes into that is very clear. There's not a lot of surprises. They're very, very streamlined procedures in terms of what you can expect to happen. It's not like you get into a car accident and, you know, you don't really know what you're going to need. It's there's a set number of things that happen in a colonoscopy and a set number of outcomes for the most part. And so they introduced reference pricing around some of these very specific procedures and found after a couple of years in the market, not all, but like twice as many hospitals were now offering these procedures at these much lower rates. So it had actually brought the cost down for these particular procedures. What they're watching for now is to see whether or not those hospitals shift costs and make other procedures more expensive to make up for it.
Something we're going to definitely follow up with you as well. I can't let you go before we ask, of course, about there is a needle exchange proposal right now in Tallahassee.
Yes.
What's going on with that?
So this is another story I covered recently. Miami-Dade County has the only legal needle exchange program. So this is a program where injection drug users can come to the IDEA exchange, it's called, which has a fixed location in Overtown and also a mobile van that goes all over the county. And they can swap their used needles for free, fresh, unused needles. And the idea is that this is a really well-studied way to reduce HIV risk among injection drug users. If you're an injection drug user, you are at incredibly high risk compared to anybody else of getting the HIV virus or hepatitis virus. So this is really a way of getting people who are at incredibly high risk and trying to reduce the risk of HIV there.
Do we know that it does actually help in reducing?
We have seen that in other places because it has only been running for a year in Miami. It's going to take a little while to get that data back. One of the interesting things we have seen is that it has already saved lives by one of the other things they do is they hand out naloxone or Narcan, which is the drug used to reverse overdoses. And they will swap out used naloxone cartridges for fresh ones, and they have seen more than 200 cartridges come back. So that's more than 200 overdoses that have been reversed as a result of having this option.
Does this really have a chance in Tallahassee?
Well, it already did once. We'll see what happens this session. It took four tries to get the limited trial that has been legalized in Miami-Dade County. It took them 4 years to do that. One of the things that is different this year, as opposed to when they started doing this more than 5 years ago and started lobbying for needle exchange, is that the opioid epidemic has gotten much, much bigger. And so they are hoping that they'll be able to point and say, look, in Miami-Dade County, we've gotten more than 85,000 needles, 85,000 needles, used needles back. And that's a lot of needles that are not on the streets. But who knows, right? Tallahassee is anybody's guess.
Well, something else we'll be following in this legislative session. Health news reporter Sammy Mack joining us here on Sundial. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, still ahead, a conversation with author Min-Jin Lee about her National Book Award finalist, Pachenko. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Min-Jin Lee took almost three decades to write her second book, Pachenko. It follows the story of a Korean family over four generations in pre- and post-war Japan. One of the main characters is a woman named Sunja, who has to carry the burdens of her family as they fight their way out of poverty. Another important figure is a man named Han-Soo, a wealthy but nefarious character who puts Sunja in a precarious situation and yet also fights to protect her family. Pachenko is a National Book Award finalist. Min-Jin Lee is going to be talking about it at the Murakami Museum in Japanese Gardens Thursday at 7 o'clock. This is a previously recorded conversation. Min, what's most impressive about Pachenko is this is a book that covers multiple generations, a vast amount of time in history. And from what I understand, you started working on this book years ago, and you really didn't intend to write a book at first. When did the idea of this story come to you, and how?
Well, in 1989, I was 19 years old, and I went to kind of a guest lecture at my college because a friend of mine asked me to, and then I learned about the Koreans in Japan. And I didn't know anything about them. I was a history major, and the person who asked me was the university chaplain, and I didn't know how to say no. And it was featuring an American missionary who worked in Japan. So, of course, you can imagine that was like a really fun talk. So I went and I sat down, and there were only two undergraduates who attended out of the entire university. So I really couldn't leave. And the missionary was talking about the history of Koreans in Japan, which, of course, begins during the colonial era when they really started to migrate either forcibly or as economic migrants because North and South Korea at the time, which is only Korea, the entire peninsula, was incredibly poor and became poor as a result of the colonization. So we had all these people there, and that was the entire history. But then, of course, the American missionary was talking about 1989, where you have almost like the fourth or the fifth generation of the Koreans in Japan. And he mentioned a story of a 13-year-old boy who had jumped off a building and he had died. And his parents went through his things and they were trying to figure out why their son would kill himself. And they learned that his Japanese classmates had written in the middle school yearbook, "Go back to where you belong. We hate you. You smell like kimchi and garlic." And they told him the words. They wrote down, "Die, die, die." And that story made this incredible impression on me. I just really couldn't shake it because I didn't understand why in the world these kids could feel this way about their classmates based on their ethnicity, because this child was born in Japan. His parents were also born in Japan, but they were ethnically Korean. And that story really stayed with me when I quit being an attorney in 1995. I was 25 years old. I decided that I would write something about the Koreans in Japan, and I started something and I couldn't do it, and I wrote another book and that didn't go very well. And then so I worked on it from 1996 until 2003, and it was a pretty terrible book. So I didn't send it out. And then I started something else, and then the third novel manuscript that I wrote, Free Food for Millionaires, became my first published book. But I've had this thing with me, and then when I moved to Japan in 2007, I started all over again. And then that's what became Pachinko. So I've been working on it actively for 20 years. But then I guess I got the idea in 1989. So it's been with me for about 28 years.
You're Korean.
I am. I'm ethnically Korean, yes.
Yeah, you were born.
I'm an American citizen.
You were born in Korea?
Yeah, I was. I was born in Seoul.
South Korea.
And I came when I was 7 and a half.
When you were growing up, did you see and hear all these things? The things that you pointed, that xenophobia that you point out in throughout the story?
I did not. And I think that in many ways it's really odd because I've studied a lot of Asian American history and history of people of color in this country. And it's a pretty grim situation in many places. And I can point to many factors. But I grew up in Elmhurst, Queens, which is not a very posh area of the borough of Queens. And my parents lived and worked in Koreatown. And I had so much support growing up, and in New York City, I had so many people from all different backgrounds who really supported me. So until I went to college in Connecticut, I kind of thought that America was perfect. And I realized that my experience is really unusual, but growing up in the boroughs and growing up in working class neighborhoods, I felt very normal and I felt very accepted. I was taught how to read and write by, let's say, Jews, African-Americans, Latinos, gay men. I mean, I've had such an incredibly pluralistic experience in terms of my childhood. And I didn't even know about it until I realized, looking back, oh, that was, Mr. Spadafora, and he taught me how to read and write, and the librarian at the Queens Library. And then when I went to college, I realized, oh, there's something called white people, because in New York, you're not white, you're Italian or you're Polish or you're Czech or you're Jewish. It's when people, if you speak Spanish in the boroughs, they say you're Spanish, even though you're Puerto Rican or Dominican or Haitian or what. I mean, if you speak French or you come to the Caribbean islands, there's a real specific ethnicity because people are recent arrivals or maybe second generation. So when I went to college, I realized, oh, there's more of a black-white distinction and more of a binary. And that was really surprising because I didn't understand it.
You spent time in Japan. Did you see that xenophobia there?
I did. And it was really such a shock because I was there from 2007 to 2011. We're talking about the 21st century. And I was continually surprised by the way that certain people were treated and the way they talk about foreigners. So Japan's like this incredibly cool and amazing and really nice country in many, many ways. I encourage people to visit. My husband is half Japanese. My son is a quarter Japanese, consequently. So I have nothing against Japan, the country, or its people. What was really odd is that there is a very clear social norm in Japan, even today, where foreigners are perceived to be in many ways inferior. And by foreigners, there's a real stratification of what kind of foreigners. So, for example, white foreigners are not necessarily seen as inferior. But if you are an Asian foreigner, there is a real stratification of. And people really normalize saying things like, oh, the Chinese, you can't trust them, or the Koreans are really criminal. And I've heard people who are really educated and amazingly nice people say these crazy things. So it was very hard for me because I couldn't understand how could this really super nice person say something so vile. And I think in many ways it was helpful for me because as I get older, I start to realize that people are more and more and more complex. Like you can't just kind of write people off because they say something horrid, but it depends on the social norm of that country.
This is Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and you're listening to a previous conversation that we had with author Min Jin Lee. Her book, Pachinko, is a National Book Award finalist.
You talked to Koreans and Japanese before you started writing this book as as research. I mean, when you were talking to them, first of all, how did you find them? How were you looking for folks?
Well, I kind of have these wishes to be an academic and also a journalist. So I get to do that in my fiction. So when I write fiction and I write these kind of like big community novels, I conduct an enormous number of interviews. So I must have done over 150 interviews for both of my books. And I do extensive research where, so for example, for my first book, I went to Harvard Business School and I pretended to apply. And I took a class at FIT to understand millinery. So I do all this research. And then in the process, I conduct a lot of interviews. And then for Pachinko, I met and interviewed and spent an incredible amount of time with Korean Japanese people, especially where they're from. So most of them live in Osaka. So I spent a lot of time in Osaka talking to people and just kind of like following them around. And that was really helpful because it's not just what people say, because a lot of times people say things, but they really mean something else. And you kind of have to see people live and do things. And that was very helpful for me just to kind of like follow them around where they work or sit with them or see how they conduct a phone conversation or even just drink coffee or have a cigarette. Like you kind of want to see how people do things. And that's really important to me in terms of dramatizing what I do and dramatizing what I see and the things that I want to say, because I had all these preconceptions about the Korean Japanese, and then I met them and then I realized I was wrong about everything. And that was very helpful because I think that's the reason why my first book was so bad. Like the book that I wrote about the Korean Japanese from 1996 and 2003 was a lifeless book because I didn't know the Korean Japanese people. And when I met them, I realized, oh, I had to write a brand new book. And that's what I ended up doing.
Did you know you were going to write a book about them when you were interviewing?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I didn't know I was going to write a historical novel. I had no intentions of doing 100 years. Like, and it was
which is
absolutely
very ambitious.
Which was really stupid in lots of ways. I mean, I'm glad I did it now, but it wasn't like I had this grand vision. My grand vision was to write a book about the Korean Japanese, and I didn't realize that you can't write about the Korean Japanese until you start from the very beginning. But if I had known that in 1996, maybe I would have picked a different topic. So now that I've done it, I'm really glad I finished it, and I'm proud of my work. However, I didn't realize it was going to take almost 2 decades of my brain. Like just the amount of energy and attention that I've spent to the subject, especially because I was really not very confident that it would ever sell. So it was in many ways, it was not a practical choice. And it was kind of, it's kind of like when you throw in good money after bad. That's what it felt like to me. Like I kept on putting in more time and more energy. And the more I spent on it, the more irritated I became at myself, like, why are you doing this? Like, you can't be very bright.
You know, I was curious in the interviews that you did, if any of the people you spoke to inspired your characters. And if so, was there a person who inspired Sunja, or better yet, Hansu?
Oh, yeah. I met lots of people who inspired Sunja and Hansu. As a matter of fact, there are many people like that. And Sunja is almost like an every woman that I met, especially the working class illiterate women that I met. So if you go to the open markets in Asia, not just Japan, you're going to meet all these illiterate women who are really tough and very resilient and very adaptive. And just because they didn't have a formal education doesn't mean that they're not geniuses in so many ways. So I was continually surprised by the Korean Japanese that I interviewed, because they would always talk about this sort of matriarch person in their families who had inspired them, who had made these sacrifices, who did not mind, or they didn't at least profess to mind, being kinds of beasts of burden in terms of what they had to do to make sure that their sons were educated or their daughters got married. And it was that kind of very specific gender distinction, because at that generation, it was really the boys that they focused on the education and the girls not so much. And that kind of changed in the second generation. So I was really surprised, and I realized I have to write about these people because that's what happened, as opposed to when I was reading the sociology, history, economics, and law books that were about the Korean Japanese people. They didn't focus on the working class women who are illiterate. And I wanted very much to talk about illiterate people, because very often when you read Asian American literature, they focus a lot on people who are educated, because very often you have writers who have descended from an educated class who are able to migrate here based on the 1965 immigration laws. So it's a very specific community. And I wanted very much to talk about the experience of most Koreans in Korea, which were that, like, you had this incredibly humongous illiterate population until recently. And no one talks about it because it's seen as something embarrassing. And I don't think it's embarrassing. I think it's true, and it's very powerful that you have this illiterate population become this world-class economic power.
And Sunja, she is illiterate. She is, for a big part of her life, she's poor. Really, though, and again, the story that covers so many generations, so many years, she's really the key character in that she's the mother, and she, you know, we follow her from her childhood all the way through her life. Hansu, can you say he's the villain? He's really kind of guiding this family, at least financially, but not a good guy.
He's not a good guy, but I don't think he's the villain. I don't think he's a good guy. But I think he's a smart guy, and I think that he is based on people that I interviewed. I interviewed a lot of alpha males who are like Hansu, and I was surprised by them because they're not like... Well, they're certainly not like me, and they're certain not just in gender, but I think of the world in a very shaded kind of way, whereas really incredibly successful, very, very wealthy men that I interviewed who were kind of a Hansu prototype, they're very binary. Like, for them, everything's very clear. Like, if they have a wish, then they fulfill their wish, and they don't really care about the obstacles, and their single-mindedness is very helpful in order for them to become successful, but they're not necessarily moral people. And I was very surprised by their decisions and their carelessness about other people's wishes, because their wishes were so primary. It wasn't even like other people's wishes were second or third. It was almost like the 12th point, because they had a very clear philosophy. And I love Hansu as a character. He's probably my favorite character in the book, much more so than Sunja. People are always surprised when I say this, because Hansu is very exciting, and Hansu gets things done. And I think people like that are very attractive. Of course, you don't want to love a person like that in an intimate way, because they will hurt you. They will absolutely hurt you.
You've been listening to a previous conversation that I had with author Min-Jin Lee. Her book, Pachinko, is a National Book Award finalist, and she's going to be talking about the Korean experience in Japan pre- and post-war at the Murakami Museum and Japanese Gardens Thursday at 7 o'clock. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Let's go back to our conversation with author Min-Jin Lee. Her book, Pachinko, is a National Book Award finalist, and she's going to be talking about it at the Murakami Museum and Japanese Gardens tomorrow at 7 o'clock. She joined us from the NPR studios in New York.
Something that jumps out at me in this book, and it's a phrase that I'd seen a couple of times, but early on in the story, you hear this. A woman's life is endless work and suffering. And as you're reading through this story, whether it's Sunja, her mother, her sister-in-law, actually, it is almost this endless suffering. Now, is it because of the times? And as you said just a moment ago, that so much of the focus was on making sure the boys got the education and that the boys got the advantages. Is it just the times, or is that really just kind of the view of how women in Korea or any Asian country is viewed?
I think that poor minority women around the world today suffer inordinately, and the way they suffer in a different way than men do, because men who are poor suffer inordinately around the world, is that because patriarchy is still quite present in many nations around the world today, they suffer in a very specific kind of way. And because of their biology, because they have to bear children, if they bear children, they are responsible not just for their own well-being, they're responsible very often for the next generation and their progeny. Their suffering is very specific. And I never walked around believing that a woman's lot was to suffer, but so many Korean women told me this, that after a while I just felt like, oh my God, I guess I better write this down, because it's something that they believe in. It's part of their philosophy and our guiding principle for running their lives. After a while, I started to think about it more instead of just being resentful of being told this. And I realized that as an American, I don't think of my life as endless suffering. I don't. As a matter of fact, I have a great deal of joy in my life as well as suffering. There's a lot of things that are going on. But I think in a way, their belief and their philosophy was really helpful and very realistic, because sometimes in the West, especially in a wealthy, powerful, and wonderful country like America, you can tend to think that you can avoid suffering. But of course that isn't true. Everybody suffers. Like, even the wealthiest person, the most beautiful person, suffers. And I think this worldview of life having suffering can temper the way you look at life, because not in a cynical way, but kind of in a realistic way, that you can expect suffering around the corner. Even if you have an amazing thing happen, that it can occur. And once it does occur, you can't be that surprised. You can't just get depressed about it. You will take action. And I think in that way, to tell a person that life suffering is coming is, in many ways, I guess it's an act of kindness, and it's almost like a wise advice. And I think that point of view came to me only after spending an enormous amount of time with the people in Japan who were ethnically Korean, as well as just like getting older. I'm 49 years old, and I realize more and more that life has all this light and dark in it, and it's this interplay that's so fascinating and important. So I can't say that I'm a pessimist in any way at all, but I'm not necessarily an optimist. And in order to kind of accept life the way it happens, it's probably very helpful to think that suffering occurs. Like, I don't really believe in the pursuit of happiness, which I think has made people really, really unhappy. I believe that you could be grateful. Like, I think gratitude is really important. I think purpose is very important. I think acceptance is very important.
And you see that throughout the book, because mm-hmm. the the women, at least in the story, are constantly reminding themselves of what at least to be grateful for, whatever little food there is, or the opportunity to sell kimchi, you know, at a train station, and having even a roof over their head. The book is called Pachinko, and that's a popular game.
It's an incredibly popular game in Japan.
Remind people how it's played.
Well, it's such a weird thing because it's a game that's very specific to Japan. It's really nowhere else. Like, they might have a little bit in Taiwan, but only as a residual aspect of the colonial era when Japan was in Taiwan. So pachinko is a $203 billion industry. It is a very important cornerstone of the Japanese economy. So $203 billion per annum is twice the export revenues of the Japanese auto industry. That's how important pachinko is. But of course, it's virtually unknown in the West and around other countries. Even in Asia, most people don't know about pachinko because it's very specific to Japan. And you really can't go anywhere in Japan. Like, there isn't a train station that's nearby that doesn't have a pachinko parlor. And they could be very small parlors or very big parlors. It's a vertical pinball game. It's only for adults. It's not for children. And it's intended for gambling. So you're supposed to try to make money from it. So whereas in the United States, you have these gambling centers that are kind of far away and you have to drive somewhere. So, like, let's say you fly to Vegas, or let's say you go to a parlor and you gamble, but you don't think of it as a daily activity. Well, with pachinko, you can play it every day. And as a matter of fact, once a week, one out of 11 people in Japan play it weekly. And that's the reason why it can be such an incredibly important part of the economy. This business, however, again, a social norm, is considered low class. It is considered dirty. It is considered criminal. And yet, most middle class Japanese people play pachinko. Not most, but you can say at least a good 10% of people in Japan play pachinko regularly. And this industry is heavily dominated by ethnically Korean people. And why is that? It's because the ethnic Koreans were not allowed to have regular mainstream jobs for a very, very long time. And even now, they're not necessarily hired for ideal positions. So they have to do independent businesses and have small businesses. And one of the industries that hired Koreans was pachinko. So they became very big in it because they were allowed to work in this business. Unfortunately, all the negative attributes of pachinko are imputed on ethnic Korean people today. So, and vice versa. So if ethnic Koreans are seen as criminal or dirty or shifty or deceitful or untrustworthy, that is also put on pachinko and vice versa. And this continues right now.
This is Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. And you're listening to a previous conversation that I had with author Min Jin Lee. Her book, Pachinko, is a National Book Award finalist. She's going to be speaking at the Murakami Museum and Japanese Gardens tomorrow at 7 o'clock.
These pachinko parlors don't come into the story until much later. And it is one of the reasons the family can get itself out of its situation. But when you were writing this, did you have that title in mind early on?
No. No, not at all. It was initially called Motherland.
Motherland?
Mm-hmm. The first version was called Motherland because I was interested in what it means to have a home when you lose your home in a diaspora. So, you know, America is pretty much made up of people who have left somewhere else. So I was interested in what happens to immigrants eventually, let's say the second generation, third generation, fourth generation. What do you call your motherland? And so that was really kind of like an intellectual focus for me. But then the more time I spent in Japan, and I realized how adaptive and resilient the Korean Japanese were, even though they knew that the situation was very unfair and rigged, much like a pachinko game, they continued to play on and they continued to adapt and they continued to participate and they didn't run away because they really had nowhere to go. Like, they couldn't go back to Korea. They don't even speak Korean. They know nothing about Korea. And when they did go back to either North or the South, because the peninsula was divided and became two different republics in 1948, they had no space because most Koreans in Japan came from the southern region, but they couldn't go back because the South was incredibly poor until pretty much 1970s.
What has been the most surprising, I guess, experience for you, whether it's something that you've heard from someone, you know, comments from readers about this novel?
I can't believe how many people are reading this book. Like, it's such a shock. And I'm not even being modest. Like, I didn't think I was going to sell this book. It didn't, like, when I was working on it, I was really depressed in lots of ways because it's such a specific community. There's only about 600,000 Koreans in Japan, and I don't know why it possessed me so completely, but I really felt like I had to finish this book. And I'm a big finisher. Like, whatever I start, I finish. I'm just not very fast. And I thought that after I finished it and sold it, that it would be, you know, I can go to the next thing. And I had some financial issues, like some personal financial problems. And I kind of thought, like, wow, I really was such a dope because I should have done something else. And I had given up being an attorney. So I'm so surprised. And it's been read by so many people who are really powerful. And like recently, like the First Minister of Scotland read it. Like Caroline Kennedy has read it. The President of the World Bank read it, and they wrote to me. It's like you're just really shocked.
What did they say?
They actually reach out to me through my website, and they say incredibly nice things about how much the book meant to them. And I can't tell you how weird that is. Like, the First Minister of Scotland tweeted about it, how it was one of her favorite books of the year. And I didn't expect that. And someone alerted me to it. And I've had editors from magazines all over the planet contact me. And I was like, wow, that is so weird. So it's a real surprise. And I'm really humbled by it because I think throughout the entire process, I felt like I wanted to honor the stories that people had told me. I wanted to get it right. And in that sense, I spent an enormous amount of time doing the homework. So I'm glad I did the homework. I'm glad that I got the history and the law correct. However, I didn't realize that it would take 20 years of actively working on a work of fiction.
20 years worth doing, though.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely.
Thank you.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on the third part of the trilogy. So Free Food for Millionaires, Pachinko, and my next book is called American Hagwon. They're part of my diaspora trilogy called The Koreans. And the third book is called American Hagwon. Hagwon, H-A-G-W-O-N, is a tutoring center that Koreans usually use to send their children for different subjects or for specific exams. And so children in South Korea go to these tutoring centers after a full day of school. And some kids can spend, you know, anywhere between, let's say, 4 p.m. until 11 p.m. at these tutoring centers. You can go to one tutoring center or you can go to multiple tutoring centers. And they have them for everything. Now, these Hagwons are also around America, all over the world. Wherever you have South Koreans, you're going to have Hagwons. So I'm writing about the role of education for Koreans around the world in the diaspora and what it means to them. So if you had asked me what is the most important thing for a Korean, I would have to say more than religion, more than money, more than class, more than, I don't know, beauty or power. They care about education. So I wanted to talk about education and what it means. I wanted to write about the people who teach at these Hagwons, people who own the Hagwons, the students and the parents. And my big metaphysical question, I think, is how do you live a wise life? And how is wisdom distinct from education? Because I do think they're different things.
And again, that's author Min Jin Lee. Her book, Pachinko, is a National Book Award finalist. She's going to be talking about it at the Murakami Museum and Japanese Gardens tomorrow at 7 o'clock. I'm Luis Hernandez. You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. Have a good one. We'll talk to you tomorrow.